Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Another firefighter died this week battling the largest wildfire in the history of California, where two other fires persist in a season of extreme blazes and weather around the world. We're talking about extreme weather today, what it is, how it is, and how it isn't related to climate change. Journalist Alyssa Greenberg has been covering the California fires for The Guardian. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Alyssa.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Describe the extent of the fires in California right now, starting with the Mendocino Complex fire.
I mean, it's just incredible. It's sort of unprecedented. Mendocino, I think, is larger than 300,000 acres at this point. The Carr fire, which is where I was covering, about 150 miles north of the Bay Area, is 200,000. Yosemite has been on fire for some time. Southern California has its own fires. It's just enormous.
And the big difference is the size or the endurance of these fires, or how long they've lasted or how soon they started. What's the big difference?
Basically, everything about this is different. For one thing, so California has a traditional fire season. A wet season and a dry season, and obviously the fire season is wet. I mean, is dry. Mm-hmm. But the fire season, there was some study that came out recently that shows that the fire season lengthened by 78 days in the last 50 years. And in fact, last year, the Thomas Fire, there were firefighters fighting that on Christmas Day, which has never happened before. So it's, first of all, it's about the amount of time that this takes up. And then the fires are larger. I had a firefighter tell me yesterday that it used to be that a big fire was 10,000 acres. And obviously, you know, the Mendocino fire is 300,000 acres. That's an enormous difference. Mm-hmm. And then there's the fire behavior. Fires grow faster than they used to. There's more extreme stuff, like, for example, where I was on the Carr fire, there's something called a firenado, where a fire gets enough wind and is sucking in enough air, it creates its own weather, and there you can actually have a tornado made out of fire, which sounds like something from a dystopian movie, but is real. So put that all together, it's all different.
Have the firefighters changed how they fight these kinds of fires, given the change of the in length of the fires, the size of the fires, and the behavior?
Well, one thing that I had somebody say to me is that they have a specific system that they use to predict what the fires are going to do, like a computerized modeling system, and they're having to face up to the fact that that modeling system isn't going to work anymore, it's much harder to predict what these fires are going to do, how they're going to behave, and where. So that hasn't changed yet, but I think they're realizing that it needs to. Another thing is that there are a lot of policies in place to protect the firefighters, to make sure that they get enough rest, to make sure that they get to go home. And that's not happening as much anymore.
Because they can't afford to.
They just can't afford to, yeah.
Another thing, another factor in all of this that has changed, particularly in the last 50 years, is where humans are in relationship to the fires, right?
Yeah, definitely. That's something that we saw a lot, for example, last year in the wine country fires in Sonoma and Napa. It's a development trend in California, something that the firefighters call intermix, which is where people are building more and more in areas that used to be wild. So like you have houses and then some forest and then houses and maybe some more forest. And so that becomes, I think, very difficult to handle. If there's a fire moving through a forest, but then suddenly you have houses there, those houses are much more difficult to defend.
Is California looking at zoning for houses in relationship to this threat of wildfires?
Well, sure. I mean, there are very strict rules in those intermix situations about how a house can be built. I think there are regulations in terms of like roof materials, and there's always regulations about what's called defensible space. So how much room firefighters need to be able to defend a house that is being threatened by fire. But in terms of changing the intermix, my understanding is no, I don't think that's something that's being discussed.
Mort in Westerville, you're on the air with a journalist, Alyssa Greenberg. She's covering the California fires for The Guardian. Hi, Mort.
Yes. Hi. And this question is for her. I just heard the discussion about the requirements for housing in the fire-prone areas. The one question that I have day after day is there are roof sprinkler systems that can be installed even in old houses at reasonable cost. And I have seen pictures of homeowners using garden hoses to sprinkle down their houses, the firemen using a hose. Why is there not any discussion of the need for these roof sprinkler systems?
Okay, Alyssa Greenberg?
Well, that's a little bit outside my wheelhouse, but I mean, I can say that, you know, I've spoken to people whose homes were destroyed and who, you know, were wetting down their lawns or who were trying to wet down their homes, and sometimes it helps and sometimes it doesn't. I mean, with a fire moving at the speeds that the car fire moved, with enormous winds, you know, above 100 miles an hour, I think, you know, there's only so much that a sprinkler system can do in that circumstance. I agree that it's a useful discussion to have, and especially in California, people talk a lot about we struggle with drought, so how can we use water to help protect our homes, but also how can we make sure we have enough water, which is a real serious problem here.
Drought is another form of extreme weather in California, right?
Yes, definitely.
You wrote about a Redding, California man who defied orders to evacuate. What was he thinking? What are people thinking about this? Are they not grasping the reality or what?
Well, I think, you know, when it comes to your home, the home that you've lived in for, you know, 20, 30 years, I mean, you can trust that the firefighters are going to do what they can. But I think that ultimately there are some people, I mean, that man was a Navy veteran and his neighbor was a retired Cal firefighter. And I think they felt like, well, nobody's going to do as good a job as we are. Nobody cares about these houses the way that we do. I mean, you could make an argument about whether that was a smart decision or not. I mean, their neighborhood was overcome by this firenado. And, you know, he said, his neighbor asked, you know, are we going to die? So they certainly were putting their lives at risk. But in the end, the outcome was that his house did not sustain any damage. So, I mean, it's not certainly not something that I would recommend, but I think that people are scared and nobody really knows how we can handle this kind of stuff. Cal Fire is doing the best that they can with their expertise and the bodies that they have. But I mean, there's no clear answer here.
You mentioned the intermix earlier and we talked about whether or not, and you said that there aren't any policies in place and there don't seem to be discussing any policies to restrict intermixing, that is moving housing into formerly wilder areas. But are people, is behavior changing in regard to that at all?
Well, so this is just hearsay I have to make clear, but I have some friends who live in the areas that were affected by wildfires last year in Sonoma and Napa, especially in Santa Rosa, was the one that made the big news. And, you know, a friend of mine, his favorite restaurant burnt down in the neighborhood of Fountain Grove, which was just overcome by this amazing wall of fire on one of the first days. And he told me that they are more or less abandoning that neighborhood, that, you know, in his opinion, it never should have been built, and that it was the second time that it had burnt, and maybe people are now understanding that that's not a place where there should be restaurants. Again, that's like not a policy thing, and it's not something that I've spoken to anybody about it directly, but that's what I hear.
Yeah. And as far as you mentioned that the system that they had been using to predict fires and fire patterns and behaviors, they're kind of having to abandon that. It's outdated now. What are they embracing instead?
I mean, at this point, from what I understand, it's just the best they can in terms of, I mean, there's all sorts of systems for containing a fire that don't rely on knowing where the fire is going to be. So, okay. I mean, so for example, what this part of the system was that, you know, wildfire is a natural process. And so that a lot of these areas had burned before. Mm-hmm. And generally, the understanding was that if an area had burned recently, that was an area that maybe wouldn't burn again because there wasn't a lot of fuel. You know, the trees hadn't grown back or vegetation, that you would understand that would be a place where, for example, firefighters could make a stand against the fire. Mm-hmm. And I guess what I'm told is that didn't happen. For example, in the car fire, a lot of those areas, the fire just burned through. And so what they're having to do is instead focus on just the tried and true containment techniques while they figure out, okay, how else can we predict where these fires are going to go.
How many of these fires are caused by humans or started by humans, I should say?
I mean, I think a lot of them have some starting point that is related to humans. I mean, of course, there's, you know, dry lightning. And so we often get warnings, what are called red flag warnings, that say, like, there's likelihood of dry lightning. But for example, the car fire was started by a car, a mechanical failure of a car. I don't know the details, but that, like, I imagine something sparked or there was some something. But I mean, all you need is, you know, one dropped cigarette butt or one sparked something on a car. And, you know, these with the longer, drier summers or the summers that are dry and longer, you get, you know, a huge amount of dead vegetation. But, you know, what we talked about with the drought before, that like there were just enormous amounts of dead trees all over the state. And so that's sort of just waiting to go up. And then sort of the alternative to that is we also have had enormously rainy seasons as well, coming out of the drought, like huge amounts of rainfall. And it turns out that also contributes here because there are these explosions of vegetation after that. And then once the summer starts, that vegetation dries out, it dies, and it is prime fuel for these fires. So, I mean, you know, you can say that these fires are, some of them are being started by humans, but ultimately the process of what makes them so large, that's a separate matter.
And then the winds you were talking about that are whipping up these fire nados, is it, you're saying that they're actually starting their own weather system. The heat creates the wind, right?
Yes.
Yeah. But you're also 100-mile-an-hour winds, you were saying, that are pushing these fires. Is that unusual, or is that the typical summer high winds in California in these areas?
Well, I mean, in that case, I think it was the fire starting its own weather. But, I mean, one thing that also plays a part is the topography.
Okay.
So, you know, a lot of these areas are not flat. They have, you know, canyons, steep hills. And so when you have, like, hot, very, very hot air pushing up against cooler air and being driven up and down these hillsides, like, that's where you start to have high winds.
Some people are talking about the smoke cover that you can see from satellites and that kind of a thing and how it's moving across the United States. Have you heard any talk about that?
I've experienced the smoke cover in person in the car fire, which was I mean, very impressive as a person who has struggled sometimes with asthma.
Yeah.
And, you know, I live 150 miles south or 100 miles south from these fires in the Bay Area, and we've also had drifting smoke here. I mean, this is something that's not just contained.
Right. Well, Alyssa Greenberg, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for calling. I appreciate it, too.
Alyssa Greenberg, she's a journalist. She's covering the California fires for The Guardian. We'll continue our conversation about how extreme weather plays a role in all of this and how extreme weather is in part caused by global climate change. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A trio of massive wildfires burning in California is one example of extreme weather, part of which is a function of climate change. Midwestern agriculture suffers other burdens from the changes, harsher rainstorms and incremental temperature increases, and smoke from the fires in California. Dennis Toddy is director of the U.S. Department of Agriculture Midwest Climate Hub. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is Senior Research Associate at the Ohio State University Bird, Polar, and Climate Research Center, Aaron Wilson. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
Aaron, we're seeing extreme weather on the coasts, and that's what gets the most attention. How can you make the connection for us between extreme weather and climate change? There's all kinds of extreme weather.
Certainly. And, you know, it's very important to kind of start out what the difference is between weather and climate, right?
Okay.
So we're very in tune with weather because these are changes that are taking place on very rapid timescales. So, you know, our temperatures go up 20, 30 degrees every day. But we have established patterns, and those patterns over time are what we define as climate, so averages over a long period of time. And so making the connection between changing weather and changing climate often comes through the idea that the patterns are changing, the large-scale patterns are changing, or as temperatures increase, temperature is just one variable, and it's impacting a lot of other feedbacks within the climate system itself. And that's where we start to see these effects, these extreme weather effects, through those feedbacks. Temperature, again, being just one symptom of the changes that we're seeing. But it's also impacting things like an increase in water vapor in the atmosphere. It's increasing a change perhaps in the jet stream or how it meanders across the world. So these are the types of ideas and the connections between the changes that we're seeing just through temperature, but then all the other feedbacks in the climate system.
And when we're talking about that distinction between climate change and the larger climate patterns and the shorter term extreme weather we experience, is it relevant to talk about whether it's the climate change is affected or exacerbated by humans?
Yeah, I think there's a right way and a wrong way to frame the question. A lot of times the question is, well, was this particular event caused by climate change? A better way of framing the question is how much more likely is this event to occur given the changes that we're seeing in the climate? And that's really part of that discussion here. Climate and the changes that we're seeing are essentially a threat multiplier on the impacts that we're seeing. So the way you could frame, for instance, the wildfires, are the wildfires worse because of climate change, or are they more likely because of the climate changes and the patterns that we're seeing? And that's, again, one part of the equation. Humans and what we do and our decision is the decisions that we make is also part of that.
And a lot of times it's framed in terms of our decisions to burn fossil fuels. But I was just talking earlier about the intermix in California where people are building houses where they never did before.
Yeah, certainly. And you know, being a climate scientist, I focus more on the science
exactly.
side of things. But certainly humans have impacts in many ways. Burning of fossil fuels is one. We know that changes our greenhouse gas mix in our atmosphere, and that contributes directly to temperature increases and all those feedbacks, but also land surface changes, how we manage our natural resources. All of these things are going to be part of this story now and moving forward in terms of dealing with the climate and the impacts that we're seeing.
And Aaron Wilson, Dennis Toddy, director of the USDA Midwest Climate Hub, that's sort of where you come in. I mean, you deal with all of the different factors at once and how they're affecting our agriculture.
Very much so, yes. You mentioned early on about a lot of the attention is focused on coastal areas, which is legitimate because there are very large population centers there. Mm-hmm. We also have a lot of our agriculture that is impacted by changing climate issues in our region. Some of that is row crop agriculture. How are we, how are we dealing with corn and beans and wheat and those kinds of things, and then the soil that those are grown in? But there are also issues related to some of the food we eat. Some of the issues that we deal with are, when we're talking about warming, we're also talking about variability in when our spring freezes come. And things like fruit trees, we had this problem last year back mm-hmm. in the spring of 2017, where we had fruit trees that were blooming well before we knew we were going to get a freeze. So there are increased risk issues that are also involved, and that's part of our discussions too, is not only how it's changing, but how is our risk of being able to do our activities, how is that increasing?
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about extreme weather and all of its manifestations and how it's affecting things like the food we eat and whether or not we'll be able to eat it in the future, I guess. You just heard from Dennis Toddy. He's director of the USDA Midwest Climate Hub. Also with us, Aaron Wilson. He's senior research associate at the OSU Bird Polar and Climate Research Center. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. When I was speaking with the reporter for The Guardian last segment, she mentioned that the system that scientists out west and people guiding the firefighting efforts out there are using to predict the fires, the intensity of the fires, the direction they may even go, and how fast, it's changing. They are starting to have to abandon these models that they have been using for years. Is the same thing happening, Dennis Toddy, when it comes to how we look at our agricultural patterns?
Well, and there's two ways to look at that. There is the conceptual, or what we experience, and then there are the, what are the computer models doing that try to model what the atmosphere is doing and try to tell us what's happening. The computer models, if they're physically based models, are the equations describing what's going on. They can handle some of these larger changes and describe how the patterns are going to work in the atmosphere, and they can describe how the crop is behaving and give us some of the answers that way. But there are some of the extremes. When you're talking about extremes, those are more difficult to model. We can't always tell when extremes are going to occur, how extreme they're going to be. And we always have to be concerned about those, because oftentimes extremes are the biggest impact events we're dealing with. When we're talking about 2 degrees above average for a month, okay, may not be a big issue. But when we're talking about 10 or 15 degrees above average for a month, like we saw back in May and June, those have big impacts related to that. But then there's all this conceptual thinking, too, that especially if you've been a farmer, say, for 30 or 40 or 50 years, here's what I think is always going to happen. We're seeing some of those things change. So we're having to train people, retrain people about, hey, things are changing and you can't always do things the way that you've always been able to do them.
Has the industrialization of agriculture made us more flexible or more inflexible when it comes to dealing with these changes as they occur, however incrementally?
That's an interesting question, because we have become larger and we have become more specialized in uh-huh. how we're able to do that. Theoretically, we should be able to make better decisions because we're managing more centralized. We should be able to do that. But then in some ways you're also not flexible, because if we're farming 10,000 acres, okay, we've got to get these things done at this time period. And if we get into a rainy period, then things get pinched together from a timeline perspective, so we can't always make as good of decisions. So it is kind of a tougher, I'm not sure there's a good answer to that question uh-huh. just yet.
Aaron Wilson, we were talking about the wildfires earlier in California. The biggest in history right now is burning away. There's lost lives. And another issue, we can see from satellite footage that the smoke is traveling. It's affecting, of course, people in California very immediately, but it's traveling all the way to the into the Midwest and beyond. What's the effect of that from where you sit?
Yeah, I mean, it a lot of times depends on how far from the fires you are. I mean, obviously, there's breathing issues the closer you are to the wildfires. For us in the Midwest, and it's permeated even into the Northeast and the Southeast part of the country now, from the recent wildfires, you know, it affects, you know, the optics of the sunset, for instance. You can see that in kind of the orange and pinkish sunsets that we've had. So that's certainly kind of a side impact of the wildfires that aren't necessarily, you know, health related here because it's in the upper part of the atmosphere.
Yeah. Dennis Toddy, any impact of things like that's happening on the coast there in California in terms of agriculture in the Midwest?
From a fire standpoint, you're asking?
Yeah, from a fire standpoint.
It is an interesting contrast. You know, we would think there might be some impact, but it may not be the impact that people think of. Because when you do get enough smoke over this area, you can decrease the amount of incoming solar radiation on a day. That's usually not much of a problem because there's usually enough solar radiation for a crop to use at this point in the season. So it's not a major issue.
They've had what they need so far. Yeah, okay.
Right. And there actually could be some benefits because we do have some areas in the Midwest that are drought impacted right now, and there's some stress on the crops. If you reduce that daytime temperature a little bit from being quite as hot, you can reduce a little bit of stress on the crops. So actually, there might be a little bit of benefit there. It's not a major change, but there could be a little bit of benefit that way.
Hmm. And the Midwest temperatures, they've increased 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit between 1900 and 2010. It doesn't seem like a lot, but is that incremental temperature change you say that could be affecting when the fruit trees are blooming?
You know, when we talk about, and when you're talking about the degree and a half increase,
yeah,
that's averaged over the whole year. So we have to kind of break it down by seasons. A lot of our warming has occurred during the wintertime. We still have cold periods during the winter. We still have cold winters. But overall, we've seen more warming in our winters. And that leads to that issue I mentioned with the fruit trees, where with the warming winters, some trees and other things break dormancy a little bit earlier before we have our average last freeze, though the average last freeze is getting earlier all across the Midwest. The other issue is that some of our warming is occurring in overnight temperatures. We're not getting as cool at night as we have previously. And in some cases, our daytime highs, especially during the summertime, are not increasing or slightly decreasing in some places in the Midwest. So our overnight temperatures are getting warmer, our daytime temperatures are flat or slightly getting cooler, so our daytime temperature range is not as much as it used to be. And that's having a different set of impacts. This is specifically related to some crop production. It pushes crops more quickly through their phenological stages, corn particularly. That's not very good for it because it can reduce some yield. We're seeing more frequent warm overnight temperatures where we're having temperatures in the evening staying in the 70s or even sometimes in the 80s, which is not good for livestock. It's not good for humans if you don't have air conditioning, but it's also leading to more people having to use air conditioning, so that's producing some stress issues. It's also producing stress on livestock. If livestock can't get cool at night, they don't gain as quickly, and you can get mortality in cases like that. So that you have to kind of unpack that overall temperature increase into some of the issues that we are seeing.
Aaron Wilson, from what we know about climate change over the eons, what is this the way it's always changed in these incremental ways? Are we like frogs in a slowly heating up pot of water?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, so we've got some reliable proxy records. For instance, at the center, we use ice core
right
records that go back, and we can trace, for instance, CO2 back 800,000 years, and we can look at the temperature from ice cores as well. We can interpret temperatures from that. So, you know, throughout our time, we go through these cycles of warmer and cooler periods. And if you look at the CO2 in the atmosphere, it ranges between 180 parts per million when we're in our cooler state to about 280 parts per million in our warmer state.
Okay.
And over a very short period of time now, we've taken that to over 411 this past May. And we know the impacts of adding that greenhouse gas to the atmosphere. You know, you increase those temperatures, but there's inertia built in the system. So what we're seeing are these accelerated rate changes in terms of the temperature and then the multiple feedbacks that feed from that.
So 800,000 years from now, someone could do the ice cores and look at this period of time and say, oh, there something happened here.
Absolutely. They would see the spike in the CO2. And of course, we're talking a difference between what we're looking at, I mean, a few hundred years compared to looking at a record that's 1,000 years, you know, and interpreting those timescales differently. But certainly, you know, 800,000 years, if they're looking back at an ice core, if it's still here, that's a good question.
Yeah, right.
And to be able to see what that gas was in at the time.
Yeah, we've had the benefit of the ice cores to teach us about the past. They may not have that in the future. And also, just before we end this segment, Dennis Toddy, I wanted to talk about things like pests, insects, and crop diseases, and how you've seen the changing climate, as however incremental it is at this point, affecting those kinds of things.
You're dead on. That's another issue with some of the temperature changes. With the warming winters, while the warming winters are pleasant for us, insects, there are many insects who also like them. They don't get killed off, or they maybe can overwinter a little farther north than they used to. So they're able to regenerate and regrow more quickly, or you can have more cycles of them during a year. So that you can introduce some different issues with additional insect-related issues, and that's something that we have people looking at. Japanese beetles, something called a brown marmorated stink bug, which does a lot of impacts on crops. There are issues related to disease. We've talked about temperatures. We haven't talked about precipitation. Mm. But one of the issues that we have is more precipitation, more wet conditions. Many diseases like those kinds of warm, wet conditions, so we have more disease issues that we have to deal with. And then weeds, you know, weeds are an interesting thing. They are very competitive, and they like certain of the conditions that we're seeing right now. And in fact, there's a number of weeds that like this additional CO2, the additional carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, so they're able to outcompete some of the other crops that we're dealing with. There's a classic picture of somebody did some work on Canada thistle, looking at as in CO2 increases, the effectiveness of herbicides killing them off are going to be much more difficult. People have probably heard of kudzu. Kudzu is another thing that really likes CO2, and kudzu is a real tough thing to deal with, especially in the South, is going to continue to be an issue. So not only are we impacting our crops, but we're impacting our crops directly from disease, insects, and different weed conditions.
We will continue our conversation and also wade into the issue of policy. Still with us, Dennis Toddy, director of the USDA Midwest Climate Hub, Aaron Wilson, senior research associate at the OSU Bird Polar and Climate Research Center. Bring your questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. We're talking about the relationship between extreme weather and climate change and the things that matter to us on an everyday basis, like the food we eat and whether or not we can live somewhere. Still with us by phone is the director of the U.S. Department of Agriculture Midwest Climate Hub, Dennis Toddy. Dennis, thanks again for joining us.
Always happy to be here. Thank you.
And Senior Research Associate with Bird Polar and Climate Research Center at Ohio State, Aaron Wilson. Thanks again, Aaron, for joining us.
Yeah.
And joining us by phone now from Heritage Foundation, where he focuses on energy, environment, and regulatory issues, is Nicholas Loris. Welcome to the show, Nicholas.
Thank you for having me.
You see a connection between extreme weather events and climate change, and that some of the change is caused by humans, but you're not inclined to turn to government to address it. So I kind of wanted to talk about this with you and the others on two levels. There's how we, the policies of how we respond to extreme weather and climate change, regardless of what's causing it. And then there are the policies that affect the climate change that so, you know, is may or may not be causing the extreme weather, but often is. You're not inclined to turn to government to address it. So when we look at how we respond to this extreme weather, Nicholas Loris, what do you think about when you think about policy?
Well, I think it needs to be a combination of things. And it could potentially be a government solution if there isn't a private sector solution that's out there. But I think we need to focus on solutions that actually make a difference. And if we're concerned about slowing warming, that actually slow warming, if we're talking about adaptation and can help people cope with extreme temperatures, whether it's getting more access to air conditioning in the summertime or heat in the wintertime, or more localized approaches that help farmers cope with increasing weeds or insects that destroy crops, whatever the case may be. I think what my concern has been is this focus on CO2 reduction in a way that we need to transition away from carbon-emitting conventional fuels like coal, oil, and natural gas that I think would come with extreme costs to American families all over the country and businesses as well, and wouldn't do much to mitigate global temperatures, no matter how much CO2 is impacting the global climate. So I think we need to focus on cost-effective solutions rather than things that I see have very significant costs and very negligible, if any, climate benefits.
So you think that responding to the threat, dealing with the adaptation, there's a role for government, there's a role for centralized managing in that, but as far as reducing the CO2 reduction, that's a different story.
Well, I think it depends, honestly. If you're looking at different ways to get CO2 out of the atmosphere, I mean, there's new technologies that are looking at pulling CO2 directly out of the atmosphere that are currently cost prohibitive right
mm-hmm,
now.
Mm-hmm.
If we're sure that we want to move forward with a CO2 reduction strategy, I think we need to look at all the technologies that are out there rather than focus on, again, this large-scale shift away from affordable, reliable energy sources that provide 80% of America's energy needs and 80% of the world's energy needs. So I think it needs to be focused on broader-scale solutions and actually looking at what has the least cost to American families and what actually provides the benefit that we want.
Aaron Wilson, you know, oddly, I was asked to moderate a panel some years ago for the Bird Polar and Climate Research Center regarding the military response to global climate change. And they're very concerned, obviously, because they guard the coasts of the United States and the coasts are changing behavior, they're changing topography and all of that kind of stuff. But we didn't exactly get into the question of whether there was a role for the military in reducing CO2 and its effect on global climate change. Is the horse out of the barn? Is there much humans can do now to affect that?
Yeah, I think Nicholas framed it pretty well in terms of, you know, are we talking about policy where we're adapting to the changes
right,
versus mitigating the changes? What is clear is science tells us that because of the increase in CO2 in the atmosphere, where we've taken the carbon out of the ground and we've put it in the atmosphere, it has direct impact on the physics of our atmosphere, increasing temperatures with all those feedbacks. So for me as a scientist, right, the question is, how do we reduce the impact of, you know, how do we reduce our emissions, the CO2 emissions? And there are options, you know, that are debated in the policy up and down. If we take the attitude that humans can't not make an impact, then it's clear from science that we're going to suffer the worst of the consequences from the changes that we're seeing. So really a way to frame the question is, what can we do to mitigate the worst of the impacts that we're seeing and also adapt to the changes that are already here from increased, you know, rainfall and flooding and changing floodplains, which impact health, they impact transportation. So I think that's a way that we really need to frame the question is, if we just give up and say there's nothing we can do to change the gases or change and mitigate the climate change, then we're certainly accepting then a choice then to suffer the worst of the consequences. And so I think that's the way the conversation's framed.
Yeah. Nicholas Loris?
Yeah. And that's largely, you know, how I feel. And I think if you have some faith in technological innovation that can happen in rapid scale form, maybe I'm more of an optimist than some here. But I think if we want to both adapt to a changing climate and prepare for more extreme weather events and natural disasters, which are going to occur with or without increases in CO2 emissions, you know, it makes sense for those decisions in some respects to be made at the state and local level where they can build higher seawalls and, you know, they know which natural disasters are going to most likely be impacted by. And at the same time, take a look at the broader implications of what increasing CO2 emissions means for the climate and prepare in the best way that we can.
But don't we already know what increasing CO2 emissions means to the environment? I mean, isn't that been established?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that, yes, CO2 emissions are causing a warmer environment, and they're going to continue to do so. But I do think there's interesting science out there as to what a doubling of CO2 emissions will do to an increase in global temperatures. You know, if you look at climatologists' projections of equilibrium climate sensitivity, you're talking about estimations anywhere from 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius to 3.5 to 4 degrees Celsius. And then those projections have wide range implications for all of the other things that a warming world brings. And so, you know, I do think we know the direction that these events are going. But at the same time, I think when you look at some of the catastrophic scenarios, I don't know if that's necessarily true that we're headed there.
Is there a tipping point, Aaron Wilson? You know, everyone saw the day after tomorrow and there was like it was a cataclysmic tipping point. Is there such a thing in all of this anyway? Despite Hollywood's ridiculous notions?
That's a very interesting question. Some would argue that we've hit it. Others argue that it's in the future. And so, I mean, I think there is certainly scientific rigor around that question, you know, determining if we hit that point or not. I think, you know, certainly we see climate scientists essentially use these models to make projections. And the way we look at it is, in how the IPCC has moved toward looking at the projections in the future is really, okay, we've got decisions to make. Are we going to start to limit the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere? Is it just going to continue as is? And depending on what you do, the scenario in terms of impacts on temperature are different, and they're significantly different. You know, where you go from an Ohio that might be 2 to 3 Fahrenheit warmer to perhaps 8 or 10 degrees warmer on an as-is kind of scenario. And so we have to think about, I guess I don't give a lot of thought about tipping points, because then it's like, okay, well, if we hit the tipping point, does that just mean that we're going to just stop caring and stop doing things? No, we need to be vigorously seeking solutions to adapt and mitigate to the changes.
And then, Nicholas Loris, I wanted to ask you about this issue of this kind of creeping climate change. It's not something that most of us really worry about on a day-to-day basis, for sure, but it is starting to affect our crops and what we eat and the cost of our food and that kind of a thing. So, I mean, that can really affect the everyday American's pocketbook as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's cost to a changing climate, and there's benefits in terms of a warming world, too, and greener crops and healthier yields. And at some point, you know, maybe those benefits even turn to costs over time. And again, to me, I think with a creeping climate, you have a little more time to respond to the costs and the challenges and create opportunities rather than simply face the facts of those costs. And you can have more localized solutions that better protect those crops and better protect, you know, flood irrigation systems and create stronger buttresses against natural disasters without some, again, grand scheme to, I think, transition away to carbon-free energy sources, which to me seems like the biggest attempt to deal with climate change that is not actually doing anything to mitigate global temperatures. And we would have these types of transitions and cost the climate, even if we did make that rapid scale transition. And again, that's not to say we shouldn't use more renewables or more nuclear, but I think it should be more on a cost competitive basis rather than pretending it's a solution to climate change, because I just don't see how that large scale reduction, especially since this is a global challenge, would actually mitigate global temperatures to mitigate those costs to the agricultural sector. And all over the economy.
Dennis Toddy, I want to just pull you in here just for a second before we go and talk to you about how much agricultural interests are turning to you for turning to the government for guidance on coping with these changes. Dennis Toddy?
Yes. Sorry, muted there. We are having that discussion, and everywhere we go, we start with the topic of what is changing, and people understand that the conditions are changing. And unfortunately, they're changing in many ways already. We're losing yield because of issues related to too much heat stress, limited water. You talked about the fires in California. We have major drought issues in parts of the Midwest right now. So we are experiencing yield loss already. We are experiencing soil loss because of excess precipitation. We haven't talked about that very much. But yes, there is great concern. Large agri companies are already understanding that we have serious changes ahead of us in the way of what is happening with the climate, and are trying to adapt to that condition. That's the problem, though, is we can't adapt to the potential conditions in front of us, that there are too many extremes that we're not going to be able to deal with from an agricultural perspective.
Well, as I always say after a show like this, it's an ongoing conversation, and I appreciate the your participation today. Dennis Toddy, director of the USDA Midwest Climate Hub, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And also Aaron Wilson, Senior Research Associate at the OSU Bird Polar and Climate Research Center. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
And Nicholas Loras, economist, focused on energy, environment, and regulatory issues with the Heritage Foundation. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thanks again for having me.
Thanks again to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.